Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Crutella and Dr. William Houston Wilkinson for part one of their discussion on Ubuntu, Race and Reconciliation, the Real Meaning of Spiritual Interconnectedness. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
It's such a pleasure to be back, Bill and I. We haven't known each other really long, but then you moved to Medina and it's just been hard to get together. So I really appreciate your willingness to do this.
It's good to live into the connection that we have.
It is. Yeah, I've been missing it. And so I really like and enjoy the chance to do this. The title today is an interesting title, Ubuntu, Race and Reconciliation, the Real Meaning of Spiritual Interconnectedness. And that is so Dr. Wilkinson. So a little bit about, if you don't mind, I just know you as Bill. So Reverend Wilkinson is a pastor, teaching elder of the First Presbyterian Church in Medina, New York. But William brings his experiences as a sociologist, hospital worker, sheet metal worker, I love that story, physical physician, scientist, his MD from Yeshiva University, along with his theological education, master's in divinity from Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School, to the building of missional church and congregation-based community organization. He was raised in Boston, Massachusetts. Began the practice of community partnership facilitation in the New England peace movement, deepened it in healthcare union struggles in New York City, community-oriented public health in Kenya, East Africa, and as a sheet metal worker in Western New York. He's the founding governor of Rochester Area Communities Transforming Society, an affiliate of the Chicago-based foundation. He served on the boards of the United Christian Leadership Ministries in Western New York, the National Black Presbyterian Caucus, and the Greater Rochester Community of Churches Faith in Action Network. William is a co-recipient of the 2017 Ecumenism Award by the New York State Council of Churches, and he's engaged in the partnership and community chaplaincy ministries of the Medina Area Association of Churches, a Harvest Neighborhood of Presbyterian Congregations in the Presbytery of Genesee Valley, and the Working Group on Race and Reconciliation of the Synod of the Northeast. So William, I want to ask you, your definition of Ubuntu. You were really clear you wanted to use that word when we talked.
This is a time in history when it's not just about changing to a different concept to help us move forward. It's about recognizing what has always existed, which has had many names, acknowledged in every religion and every secular idea of humanity, that for me was captured so well by the Zulu concept of Ubuntu. That is to say, I am because we are, and we are because I am. It's the ultimate for me expression of something that is alive in my own Presbyterian Christian faith, and my understanding of the biblical faith that connects Judaism and Christianity, just captured in that one word.
How do you see that being lived out now? Or I think it's hard to live that out. We don't always feel like that's happening. Mm-hmm. And right now there's a lot of, you know, races up again and really coming to a head. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about that?
Engaging in discussions about race and racism, of course, reconciliation, really brings you back to trying to understand first things and understanding that as human beings, we've developed language and concepts, you know, languages that come from geographic places, some of those geographic places related to one another, that are our human attempts at capturing something which is beyond our understanding fully, because it comes from a creation that happened before there were human beings of consciousness. And so everything has to be taken with a big grain of salt. In the Bible, it talks about the importance of salt, who are the salt of the earth. And also Gandhi, of course, the whole salt march, because salt is so important. The role of salt in preserving food, as well as giving it some flavor. So with that in mind, let's go back first things. Every human being is descended from someone, either from the Olduvai Gorge or some other place not that far from it, from the earliest time. And so in that sense, we're all African in origin. You know, and a lot of stuff has been talked about in National Geographic magazine, where people have found evidence of that in England, people found evidence of that in Australia, and it still all comes back to us being actually related, period. Doesn't matter who you think you are, that is the reality. But in the course of human beings trying to work out the idea of control and out of fear, and before we could really understand that we've been given a brain to think about the idea of being afraid or not afraid, people who wanted to control developed the idea that their symbol, their rachis, was the symbol. So, of course, for the Roman, rachis, race, is just a symbol. But in the European conquest of the world, they really began to rarefy this, and they got the Christian religion in particular in on the deal, so that somehow they made a reality of something which is not a reality. They created the concept of race as the defining qualities of kinds of human beings. Franz Boas, the Columbia University anthropologist in the early part of the 20th century, and he started measuring people who were from the so-called races, the so-called Mongoloid race, the so-called Negroid race, the so-called Caucasoid race. And he measured their physical characteristics, mental characteristics. And after all that, he wiped his brow and said, there are no measurable, observable differences between what we call the so-called races. But by that time, of course, we had gotten really good as human beings at distributing wealth, continents, countries, control, goods, even people using those concepts. Hard to let them go. And they left us here with institutionalizing some of those false ideas, structuring things like slavery, Jim Crow. Even if you look at the nation of immigrants, we channeled our immigration so the people from Southern Europe could come and serve the ones who say that they were from Northern Europe and Western Europe, leaving us in the 21st century saying, oh my God. Du Bois said that the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the color line, but we in the 21st century are left with the real problem, reconciling the families of humanity. It's not about making the connection. The beginning of our way forward as human beings or members of the whole world family is recognizing our relationship, seeing what has interfered with its being lived into, and then grabbing a hold of that. Martin King's idea of the beloved community wasn't that we should be building the beloved community, but we should be recognizing the beloved community.
I think you have a point. It's so long and so ingrained that, one, a lot of us speaking as a white person, you don't even know it. It takes some awareness. I don't have a lot of black friends. I grew up in a small town. It was 30 miles outside of Boston, which might have been two states away. And my parents were first generation American. Their parents had come from Italy. Mm-hmm. And I remember them being very careful because they felt that they had been discriminated against. And they were coming out of that. And they didn't speak a lot about it, but you could tell by the way they would talk that they were aware of that. It's something I noticed, but I didn't have, you know, we were in a white community and I went to a white Catholic school. The big deal there was that it was the Irish school and I was an Italian. Mm-hmm. That was the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I went to medical school in Nashville and that was an eye-opener. As soon as I walked into the hospital door, I noticed it. And the first thing I noticed is the doctors were white and all the maintenance staff were black. And I just never forget that.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is, for me, is becoming aware and then realizing there are things that I'm not even aware of. You know, one of the things I loved about meeting you and talking with you is it started to come naturally about we could talk about it. you were part of a wonderful book discussion that I'll always remember about The Cross and the Lynching Tree.
Yes.
And it wasn't just the book. I remember we were in a small group. I don't know if you were in my small group, but there were two African-American women who had been little girls in an area where lynching was active.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe their dignity and how they were inviting discussion. There were things they could not talk about.
Yes.
But it was way too painful.
Yes.
But I was amazed that they could even be there.
Well, there were some people from the Trinity Emmanuel Presbyterian Church who hosted the group of us from the various backgrounds who were really reluctant to participate in that 7 weeks together. They said, I've never expressed my feelings about this in front of white people. So really the question was, is it safe?
Right.
Will I be further hurt? And one of those people about 4 weeks into our 7 weeks together said in the small group, just what I just told you. He shared how difficult it had been to simply just be in this process. Did white people really care? One of the things about being a person of color, so-called person of color in the United States, and being from my background, 30 miles from where you grew up, I grew up, and there's the spirit thing in that, meeting at this point in our lives and be chasing after this reconciliation, this right. recognition of humanity thing.
Right.
But if I wanted to get away from these realities that racism exists and people have structured us and separated us and kept us from being together, mm-hmm. I couldn't. So there comes a point in the life of every person of color where they have to decide, are you gonna have a bowel movement or are you going to get off the pot?
Right.
And so then you finally realize, you know, you have to have a bowel movement, get off the pot, flush, and recognize it's part of being a human to deal with all the stuff of life. And at a certain point, you say, oh, this is good, because it's getting rid of the illusion. When I was early college, I'd be upset, you know, disillusioned, that, oh, you're disappointed. And then I began to understand that to be disillusioned is to get rid of the thing that's blinding you so that you can see, like the guy who wrote Amazing Grace. He actually became blind and began to see what life was really all about. Those are really gifts. And I think if we can not be afraid so that the truth doesn't make us fear, but truth creates little lights of light so that we can see more and more how things really are, even how they might be, if we see how they really are, that's the joy of living. That's the joy that's in the midst of the darkness.
Yes.
But you know, your eyes become accustomed to the dark after a while and you can see.
Right.
And then more light comes and more light comes. Even an amber light might come.
Amber light inspiration, right?
That bright light can be blinding sometimes.
One more comment about The Cross and the Lynching Tree. You know, there's a lot of talk, and maybe you want to talk about it too, about white fragility. And I've wondered about that with myself, and I can feel the guilt. But in that small group, it's interesting because of the story you told. I couldn't believe that those women felt safe around me. It wasn't that I was feeling guilty. That's not what came up right then. It was, I was amazed, and it brought tears to my eyes, that they could be in a room with a white person and talk as much as they could. And that's why I think of them as, how could you do that? The nobility of doing that. And I really felt, it's not like I got to know them very well, but I felt a willingness to be there. They didn't have to speak. They didn't have to be there. They didn't have to take a chance.
Yes.
And that just spoke reams to me. And it's something that I look up to. I aspire to, I don't know if I could do that. And I just try to remember that. And that gave me some impetus to want to learn more.
Yeah.
Part of this talk is about the real spiritual interconnectedness, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really walking your talk.
Yeah.
And it really made me think about, what's that foundation that they have, that you have, that I wonder if I have, if I weren't in such a privileged position, could I really do that? I wonder if you could talk to that a little bit, about that nobility that I sensed and that I really aspire to.
You touched on just something that is built into our capacity as human beings that the team that put all that process together tapped into. Recently, we lost from the land of physical experience, Wilma Campbell, the wonderful Quaker person who really helped us see that talking about this book, Frost and Lynching Tree, was going to best happen if we did it from the point of view of many people of faith, of different faiths, different humanistic ideas. And it was only going to be good if we invited people from the communities of faith of which we were a part. So the background of that particular discussion is that people who were the workshop leaders invited folks from their congregations, from their communities to come. So everyone who came in had a certain element of trust because they trusted those who had invited them. In the reading of that book, they all in the introduction read James Holmes' idea that I'm writing this book because I don't have any hope that it'll make a difference. I'm not writing this book for an agenda, he said. I'm ready because probably the last book I'm going to write, and it wasn't, but it was almost. And I just got to get it off my chest. How the hell can people be lynched and then be praying with one another? Can we pray before you lynch me? Because we're all Christians. And there was something in that book because he just shared experiences. And then Wilma said, let's get this guy who did the movie about lynching so that we have a common experience, he said, before we discuss the book. Somehow in the preparation and the invitations by people who you knew and trusted and the shared experience of seeing that movie, somehow we were all on the same page. None of us like lynching. All of us have an idea of how bad this stuff was because we just saw it last week. Remember, it took some weeks before those ladies shared like that.
Mm-hmm, you did, right.
So they came with trust, and we all came with trust. You know, we didn't have the problem in those 7 weeks of people saying, you, we are talking about this thing called lynching. And so one of the beauties of that 7 weeks is that we came in recognizing in our own way, each in our own way, that we're connected, and that somehow it was right for us to be talking, even if it might be uncomfortable.
Right.
Isn't that telling us something about this ongoing conversation, a recognition of our connectedness? Taking some comfort in the fact that tapping into the thing that is, and you're coming from wherever you're at, talking with folks who you know are also recognizing that same beginning. And so now, what's the work?
Right.
One of the things that Bishop Tutu, when he talked about Mandela and Ubuntu and all that, the concept of Ubuntu is a universal one. I remember in the book, The Words of the Earth, that Beaumont Newhall edited, used Cedric Wright's pictures, and he used the words of Walt Whitman. And one of the pictures was of a campfire with, and a lot of it was natural stuff, but there was in the middle of this book about nature, a campfire with what they call a jerry can that the hobo would always have on the fire for the next person who might come along so that they could get a hot cup of coffee. And so in that concept of Ubuntu, Mandela describes how the people who would always be ready for a stranger to come into the village, they would always have a fire going and ready to feed whoever might come. And the reason why is because they are part of Ubuntu. They're the part of us with whom we do not know yet that will come. And so one must always be ready for that person.
Right.
In the movie In My Country, it's a story based on the life of a South African writer who was a part of the people who wrote about the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions after Mandela became president that were led by Bishop Tutu and his team. In this one scene, and of course it's fictional, but they took the real stories and made fiction out of it. This one scene, because the format of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions was the perpetrator would say, I did this. And the victims, if they were still alive, or their families would be hearing this. And as long as you told the truth and took responsibility, you would be absolved. And so this one story, this little boy sitting there, he's about 8 years old, and this sergeant and a captain were describing how they had killed this boy's parents in front of him. As the sergeant of police was in the witness chair, finished his story, the little boy gets up out of his seat. First time I saw it, I said, oh, this little boy's going to go over and he's going to slap this man. Little boy slowly gets out of his seat, walked toward this sergeant, arm around him. And the sergeant says, I will pay his school fees. I will treat him as my own. And then, of course, after that scene, the next scene, the American journalist who's black and the white journalist who's South African come to see someone who she's known all her life. The American journalist, he says, "What is this Ubuntu?" And this old man says, "No, Ubuntu, this is what we believe. You know, I am because we are, and we are because I am." And the black American journalist is just beginning to understand and let the anger drift from his shoulders and his attitude and just share that they're all there trying to understand and trying to be a part of something coming together which has been torn apart.
Yes.
For me, that became a major lens for me to see what is right there in the scriptures, Gospel of Matthew 7:12. Jesus says, "So then do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And then most importantly, this is the law and the prophets. Mm. We often get caught in the quagmire of this was one thing that was said in the Bible and it's contradicted by this other thing. But if you look, there are places in the Bible where the thing is said in a few words and it becomes a way of seeing the whole thing. And by the way, those who have studied this in the Charter for Compassion group that wrote the charter in 2009, they discovered that in all written versions of faiths all over the world, the golden rule is there. That's why the Charter for Compassion is written based on the golden rule, because it is a universal which was recognized from all people who talked about human spirituality and bothered to write it down.
Good point. Thank you. Mm.
The challenge, I believe, of the 21st century is reconciliation. Reconciliation of men to women. Reconciliation of people of different gender identities. Reconciliation of nationalities, which of course are all artificial. Reconciliation of the so-called races. Reconciliation within the so-called races. You cannot be reconciled unless you recognize your connection. A wonderful writer who wrote The Art of Peace, when he was in the military, he was in the Iraq wars, he was on the general staff that helped to create the peace after that series of wars. And he became a peacemaker writer. And he said, "The heart of what I write and the heart of peacemaking that I experienced on the general staff was respect." The point where the opposing leaders could respect one another around the negotiation table. Now, I believe that respect is the recognition of the validity of the other. I believe that unless you recognize your own validity, you cannot recognize the validity of the other. To relate this to what Henry said, white fragility has to do with someone has always told the average white person, "You're not valid." Why? Well, you're not a Northern European. You're not white enough. You're too Southern or too Eastern. But if you just call yourself white, then you'll be all right. And reality comes along and you see that being white is not real. But if you've tied your identity to something that's not real, your first tendency is to try to reach and protect it. And then the more you reach, you find yourself grabbing a hold of something that's not real and it breaks. And you find yourself fragile because you have identified with that falsely. Recently, I read something on Facebook about a guy who he was talking to white people. He said, "I'm a white person talking to white people." And he talked about his grandmother, who was Irish and loved being Celtic, who had spent most of her life not telling people that she was Irish, who were outside the family, and being very so-called racist. And it was because she had accepted the culture that who you are is not good enough. When the reality is, as a black person, when I hear about what happened to the Irish at the hands of the English 100 years ago, oh, man, it makes slavery look like child's play. You mean you could be Irish and because you couldn't pay your rent, they take the roof off your house, which means you freeze to death. At least the master gave us a house. So in the recognition of oneself as being valuable, then one's history becomes valuable. So there is no teaching black history unless we're teaching Irish history. There is no Black Lives Matter unless all lives matter. But all lives can't matter unless Black lives matter.
Right.
It's about recognizing the validity of us all and not mistaking your self-pride for something that's unique to you. A white guy who was my teacher when I was a camper, he had this wonderful song. I only remember parts of it, but I use it sometimes in teaching. He said, "I'm proud to be me, but I also see you're just as proud to be you. It's plain to see we think and act differently. but lots of good people do. Yes, I'm proud to be me, but I also see we're just as proud to be you.
Thank you. This idea of reconciliation, I was just listening to a TED talk and then another talk by Ibram Kendi before he published his latest book. And he was talking about the previous book where he looks at how racism was established. And he made an interesting point, which was he went into it thinking people have racist ideas so that if you educate, you can change those ideas because it's those ideas that created policy.
Yeah.
And he said that's not what he discovered. What he discovered is that people were, I'll paraphrase it, basically greedy, wanted to hold on to what they had and would do anything to keep it, including coming up with this idea that people were less than. That's an interesting twist to it.
There's one line of American Black history writing that describes the history of slavery from looking at the logs on merchant ships. And they talk about how before about 1450 or so, if you look in the logs of merchant ships, you find a record of captains writing, people that we contacted on the west coast of Africa, wonderful civilization. They had wonderful kings and universities. But once slavery became a major source of goods and people, the captain's logs would refer to those people. We interacted with the natives of this land who were primitive and needed what we had to bring them. And their antagonisms to one another, their natural antagonisms to one another. And so wonderful mix. I mean, Ibram's idea of great, but there's a wonderful mix of human greed and fear. Remember, people who go to other people's countries to conquer them must have not been very happy at home. Well, let me see. Okay, you keep this, but I'm going to go some other place where I can take how you did it here, and I'll do it there. That human tendency to not see the connectedness, which of course is how they got my people who were Native American background. That's how they got us in Massachusetts. They got Massasoit to conquer all the people around him. And then they got the people around him to join together and help them to conquer Massasoit. And the only way to go then was to flee. Right. Remember, Lorenzo Johnson Green wrote about this in the book called The Negro in Colonial New England. He's a black writer from the Federal Writers Project. And he writes of how there were newspaper advertisements for white slaves, red slaves, and black slaves. White slaves were artisans and iron workers, mostly Irish at that point. Indian slaves were agrarian, and the black slaves could deal with animals, and the black slaves would be working on your farms. Of course, the white slaves would flee, and they said, well, let's make indentured servants. The reason why I laugh when they talk about, but that was indentured servitude. That was slavery. The only way they can enslave white folks is to make them indentured, because that fit into the European framework. But the idea here was slavery. And the only ones that they could really keep in slavery, the ones that couldn't go west because they didn't know the west was there and couldn't go home because the ships, you know, weren't going to take them.
Right.
So there's this wonderful combination of what it means to be a human being and that part of human beings that's greed and then the whole power elite.
Right.
And then the believing that the ones in power, well, they're feeding us a little bit, right? Crumbs from the table. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll go along with them. This is the danger of authoritarianism in the present period. The great man, great person, who will solve the problems that we have because we're afraid.
Right.
It was obvious in Mussolini and Hitler, and even Hirohito. It's not so obvious when it looks like us being Americans.
Right.
We're all democracy. We're all democracy, don't we?
Right.
Even though we fight whether it's a republic or a democracy.
Want to open it up if people have a question or comments? Bob?
One of the things that I think promotes this distancing, this separation, of what I call othering, is fear. And,
yes.
And I don't have enough for me and mine,
yes.
And therefore I have to make sure you don't get any more, or maybe I get some of yours.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that while the task before us is reconciliation, the atmosphere around us is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're constantly being bombarded by that, deliberately at some times, from those who would profit from the fear.
Yes.
No names mentioned. And this is the tension of the moment. Mm-hmm. I want to reconcile. Mm-hmm. It certainly makes sense to me what a wonderful world this would be.
Yeah.
But I need more.
Well, this is where part of the growing, it's all spiritual, but there's a part of spirituality that we don't often recognize enough, which has to do with personal psychology. Two thoughts about how we can begin to get into that. Certainly the whole idea of the Bowen family systems and the idea of self-differentiation comes into play. The more you become self-differentiated, self-accepted, self-understanding of how you got there by looking at the relationship that nurtured you and that nurtured your families, taking that idea, and then the Bonhoeffering idea of not being an individual, but being a socio-individual. You know, Bonhoeffer in his PhD thesis that talks about the nature of religion and the nature of the church, offers that we as human beings, as mammals, have never been alone. We are born out of women. We're carried for 9 months or so, and we are nurtured until we're able to basically feed ourselves. And so even in the feeding, other human beings are doing the farming, or we're eating, or we're doing the farming, and somebody else is eating. So in our whole existence, we are socio-individuals. We can never be. Even the hermit, even Ayn Rand's heroes are reacting to other people, right? The individuals, because they're reacting to other people. There is no such thing as an individual. So taking the idea of we are socio-individuals who then must self-differentiate, come to understand who we are and how we fit in and how we're connected and what are the boundaries, and seeing boundaries not as walls but as points of connection, now as we begin to explore all this stuff, it can begin to make sense. The less I fear, like Bob said, the less I fear, the more I am able to see more clearly who I am. Now, in the Christian religion, and in particular Presbyterians, there are things that people before us have said that if we believe them and live into them, we have some good beginnings. In our Book of Confessions in 1967, when there was all these social upheavals, our ancestors in the faith wrote this one line. It's in point 9.31 in the Confession of 1967. In the Presbyterian Constitution, says, as you are reconciled to Christ, you become a reconciler. Think about this in the context of people saying, I'm a Christian, and yet I hate, you know? Another one says, no, you can't be a Christian because you hate. If we go back to that idea that if you are reconciled to Christ, in that instant, you become a reconciler. That is to say, your calling now is reconcile in everything you do. It all then becomes a journey not of becoming saved, but of seeking to be saved. By becoming a reconciler, one oriented reconciliation, you enter the lifelong calling of reconciling somehow. Of course, we're human beings, so we're imperfect, but we can always fall down, get up, brush ourselves off, continue the job of becoming a reconciler. It's interesting that before Jesus said the golden rule, he had a whole passage of, therefore do not judge. First person that we're called not to judge is who? What do you think? Ourselves. If I'm acceptable, if I am acceptable and accept myself, there's nothing in it for me to judge you. Who am I judging? Another person who's also acceptable. It becomes then a matter of we've got to work it out. The connectedness acknowledges the validity of you and the other. Martin Buber said it out of his tradition, I and thou. It's not I over here and thou over there. It's I connected and thou. There is no I if there's no thou. There is no thou if there's no I. There is no black lives unless it's all lives. And there are no all lives unless there are black lives.
Bill, there's a question from Shanique.
Yes.
Reverend Wilkinson, do you believe religion is part of the problem with keeping people divided? During slavery, white people used religion to justify slavery.
I believe that religion is a word that we have, that the anthropologists recognize that in every human group, there is the institution of spirituality. We have, though the people in power have always used people's sense of spirituality in some cultures called religion as another tool of power. The problem is that they, in the Christian religion, people said, oh my gosh, unless we go along with the king and say, yes, the divine right for kings, he's going to get rid of the religious leader class. So we began to figure out, oh, so that we can figure out a place in this power structure. And this is where the Inquisition comes in, as one of, in the Christian faith, as one of the places where we really showed how religion got it wrong. They really went along using all the tools of the people in power and replicating them as that's what it means. So in the sense that power always tries to use religion, or groups in power always tries to use the spirituality of their culture, yeah. But we shouldn't make the mistake that religion is the problem. Just like police aren't the problem. If you have a militaristic society that has structured poverty and structured racism, and your law enforcement then enforces those laws, they're gonna have to beat people over the head sometimes. They're gonna have to chokehold people sometimes, because the laws that they're supposed to enforce are structured that way. And all they're doing is enforcing the very institutions that you have out there. So I think one of the things that I'd like to say about the present situation is defund the police. It's not about defunding the police. Get rid of the police. It's not about getting rid of the police. How about asking the question, how is our life together? How do we police ourselves? And what are the structures that we've designed for that? And who runs those structures? To me, the real importance of what's happening in the streets now is we gotta have people voting, and we have to make sure that gerrymandering goes out, and everybody has the right to vote, and that anybody that says someone's vote should be diminished, that is the person who's authoritarian. Authoritarian underneath is the real problem. People who say that they're democratic but don't believe in democracy, they believe in authoritarian government.
Thinking about religion, there's an expectation that religion has a better moral compass. I don't think it's delivered. I think it could deliver.
The problem is that people can very quickly flip the spirituality that religion should be engendering in you.
Yes.
And they say, what I'm doing is right. I'm going to use the religion that I say I believe in.
Right.
To rationalize, literally, to give reasons for the legitimacy of what I am doing. Yes. Gandhi said it better than I can. If the Christians were Christians, I think I would become a Christian too.
Right. I agree with you. But I think what I'm focusing on is, like everything else, religions, the way we think of them today, are institutions. And when you institutionalize something, things come along with it. So the religions have institutionalized racial biases. They have institutionalized biases against the other. So Christians don't like Protestants, or Muslims don't like Jewish, and et cetera, et cetera. I think you're right. I'm a believer that there's a core that I call spirituality that's, there's a psychiatrist who wrote about this, George Valent. It's genetic. We're whole beings, including our connection with a power greater than us that we call God or whatever we want to call it. That's genetic. That's real. But when you start constructing an institution around that, you bring in, I'm not sure it's necessary, but I think it's what's happened, all the things that institutions bring in that fight against that, that actually engenders a sense of superiority. It's almost like the only way I can feel not afraid is to convince myself that only I know what's going on. Only my religion knows what's going on. And that's a disaster. It's been a disaster for centuries. I think it's not spirituality. It's not that, is there a God or not? I think it's the organization. And I expect more out of religious organizations because of the job they have. Their job is to provide, in my view, a moral compass. And I think they have really failed. They tried to do it. The religions I've been part of, even within that religion, is discrimination, even within themselves.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I think it's, I really like Shanique's point, and I think it's a dilemma spoken about in The Cross and the Lynching Tree, just as you said so eloquently. How can you be a Christian and let's pray before we lynch you? And then I assume let's pray while we're lynching you and let's pray after we lynch you.
Yeah. Well, to me, this is where the hope comes from. This is why the Parliament of World Religions as a kind of institution is extremely important. This is where concept that came from an African-American Presbyterian that I didn't know, but I know his work, who coined the phrase ecumenical and ecumenically ecumenical. His concept was that if you believe in God, then you understand that the whole household belongs to God. And that each religion or non-religion that has to do with cosmology, a way of seeing the world and living that way, they're part of the whole household of God. The idea of, say, the Parliament of World Religions, they don't try to run the world. They try to tap into what is that which we all are trying to work on, which is good for the world. And the governments will run the governments. And important in religion is to see the place of religion. Spirituality doesn't necessarily lead the way.
So I think you're right. I would take it one step further. I'm not sure we're going to agree on this. I think something new is coming, Bill. And that's going to be what's new. It's going
to be. I believe that. But
it's going to actually lead the way more than the institutions.
Yes. Let me take the analogy of our own identities, right? People say, well, what are you? You know, once I was a resident, this white guy said to me, I'm at the end of his bed. He had congestive heart failure. He's doing better. Third day in the hospital. One of the miracles of knowing how to deal with that disease. By the third day, the person's really doing better. He looks at me and he says, Dr. Wilkinson, are you Italian? And I said, no. He didn't ask me anything else. He said, can you fix the blanket at the end of my bed? And as I left the room, he said, thank you, George. Now, George, for those of you who have done your history, is the name that they call all the sleeping car porters. Everybody's George. Shoe shine guy, you're George. And so when I used to tell my students this story when I was trying to tell them that your patient is your patient, doesn't promise to be anything else but your patient. They didn't promise to not be racist or anything else, they're just your patient. You have to just acknowledge that you have a relationship and you have to be working on who you are and being less and less and less afraid. And just see where the other person might be. They're still connected to you. As your faith informs how you live into the relationship. Bonhoeffer said it best. He said, in the prison, if we can conceptualize that our lives are in prison, we're about to be killed by the bad ones, if there are bad ones, but we're about to be killed by them, so we might as well live the best way we can. Bonhoeffer said, all religion, all doctrine, all belief are simply criteria for living the relationship you have to God and to your neighbor. If we can not see religion as being anything else but a guide for living. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a Presbyterian pastor. I just baptized a little girl by the lake yesterday. But I understand that this is particular to these relationships that I'm trying to be consistent in following so that I can live this relationship of God to neighbor. And I call it Presbyterianism and we call it baptism, but we don't take it to the grave seriously. My best sermon that I gave in seminary was temporarily Presbyterian.
There you go.
And what it was is, when I get to the pearly gates, God's going to say, and what were you? I was Presbyterian. Yeah, I got plenty of those.
Thank you. I know we're running short on time, but there were two more questions. One was written and one somebody is calling in.
So Margaret's asking that there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission after the Holocaust, and the contrast of these were striking. Do you think it would be helpful to have our own Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Yes, I do. Now, as I understand the whole history from after South Africa, they had Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in Serbia as well. The thing about Truth and Reconciliation, there's a framework of peacemaking internationally that says, as you gather around the table with respect, you tell the truth, you forgive someone for telling the truth, then together you build justice, and as you build justice, then comes the reconciliation. Reconciliation is the end. It is not the beginning of the process.
Yes.
Kumbaya is not what you bring. Kumbaya is a song that you sing saying, God help us, come by here, because we ain't doing it. We don't have it yet. Kumbaya, my friend, my Lord, is a call for God's help because we don't have it together. It's not saying, oh, we've got it all together, kumbaya.
Right.
See how we misunderstand things?
Yes.
Yeah. Instead of and I think raising our hands together.
And I think part of that is that we're afraid. We're yes. afraid to go through the process. We're afraid yes. to be with each other. We're afraid, what you spoke of, to face ourselves that we don't think we're valid ourselves. And we put up all of these defenses. And getting back to religion, to me, the religious institutions, instead of helping us face ourselves better, have actually done the opposite, which is really disappointing to me. I have hope, but my hope is in the natural spirituality we all have. And but I like your idea about your temporarily Presbyterian. I might take that on. I won't be a Presbyterian.
Well, you know,
maybe I will. I hang around you enough. Maybe I will.
If you look at the problem of reconciliation as one that happens in healthcare,
right,
in government, in economics, it could help to go back to Gandhi's, and Arun Gandhi talks about this a lot, to Gandhi's seven deadly social sins.
Mm-hmm.
What does spirituality tell us about those seven deadly social sins? Religion without sacrifice. Did he mean sacrificing the goat? No. Talking about giving something up of those worldly possessions, giving something up of judging other people. That's right. The sacrifice of religion.
It could be. But when, we're not going to be able to get to all the questions, but Shanique had spoken about, she had some a question about the white Jesus. And Christians can't even give up the white Jesus. So I read Reza Aslan's book, which I just love him. It's just like, it's a breath of fresh air to me. I don't know why, but it's kind of like, well, of course, Jesus was a Palestinian and he was Jewish.
Yeah.
And this is kind of what he looks like.
Well, you know what?
It was probably like.
When they finish knocking down all the statues, hoping that will change things.
Oh, you're a good Presbyterian.
We'll begin to look at, well, what's the truth of Jesus?
Right.
Because people have written about, what if we just do that? Don't say, take down that white Jesus picture. Just ask her. Let's have a seminar on who was Jesus and see what happens.
I'll take you up on that.
Yes.
I would like to invite you back again. Are you willing to do that?
Oh, sure I am.
And we'll try to continue the conversation. We need to keep talking. You've taught me a lot, and it's just, I want to keep it going.
Usual.
Yes.
Usual.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amberlight International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.